Russian and Georgian cultures like this, like this. They're your friends. They don't want to hurt you. All they ask is that you don't be part of a crescent of instability, that you don't buy into an American program designed to use your country to basically destabilize Russia. All the Russians ask you to do is be good neighbors. And if you're good neighbors with Russia, guess what? History shows they'll be good neighbors to you too. You know, America won't. Hell, nobody here in my neighborhood, if I brought out a map and said, point Georgia on the map, hardly anybody could do it. Tell me something about Georgia. Nobody can do it. I'm throwing out names of places, Kutaisi, Abkhazia. You know, I can talk about Svaneti. I can talk about Guria, Ajaria. I can say, you know, Khakheti. I can throw out all these names. People are going to go, I don't know anything about that. I say that to a Russian and go, yeah, we got that. We got that. We know it. Russia knows Georgia. Russia lives next to Georgia. They've been friends with Georgia forever. We're not. We're using Georgia for our own selfish purposes. And when we're done with it, guess what, Georgia? You'll be flushed down the toilet of history, just like Ukraine is being flushed right now, just like the Afghans were flushed, just like the South Vietnamese were flushed, just like the Kurds were flushed. You're nothing to us. We don't like you. We don't care about you. We're going to use you. Then we're going to dump you. And if you don't realize that, I'm sorry, man. But you know what? Normally, I wouldn't get so emotionally involved in this, but this is my family. This is my wife. This is her family. This is their history, and you're just basically shitting all over it, and I've had it. I'm done with it. That's why I'm going to call you out, Georgia. I'm calling out to everybody in that square. Shame on you. That law should have passed, because then the whole world would know how you sold your soul for the American dollar.
That was a clip from our last episode of Ask the Inspector, and now here we are live. How you doing, Scott?
Okay, got my blood.
It is a little unusual. We don't usually start with a video clip from our own show, because why do that when here we are? But I thought it would make sense in this particular case, because it was an especially personal issue for Scott, as he explained, and then he followed that up with an article in our Substack called "Farewell Sokumi." And basically, his premise is that the Georgian protesters are misguided. They are unwittingly imperiling their nation's survival. And I thought, you know, just to make sure people understand exactly where he's coming from and why he's so emotional about this particular issue, it would make sense to show that clip. And getting a lot of comments, you know, some people said, oh, it's too long. And to that, I said, well, watch the video. We made a video clip that we actually embedded in the article. So, you know, it's fine if some people can't read or don't want to read a very long article. But more of the comments were actually along the lines of, thank you for the history lesson. And that's a comment I saw come up more than any other. So go to scottritterextra.com. That's our Substack. We hope you subscribe. Nothing is behind a paywall. But if you would like to sign up for a paid subscription, we appreciate your support. And before we get to the questions, is there anything you want to say about that article, Scott?
No, I mean, it was an article that I felt had to be written. It's tough. My, it's a family issue. And we don't like to normally air family issues in public, but this one's deeply personal. And it's also one that will resonate in Georgia. My wife's from Georgia, Marina, and her family's there. And her friends are evenly divided. So this isn't, you know, it's not like we're going to be received with, songs and flowers. This is generating a lot of heat. But it's heat that has to be brought. This issue can't be shoved aside, can't be ignored. It has to be put on the table, and people have to put their cards on the table and let people know where they stand. There was a comment underneath, you know, all the videos that you just showed of the pro-US, pro-EU demonstrators. Today, there was a huge demonstration, bigger than that, peaceful, by the way, of what the commenter rightfully said, working class Georgia, real Georgia, conservative Georgia, coming out and saying, hell no. We're Georgia. We know who we are. We know what we are. And we're for the government. We're not for this war. We're not for going to war with Russia. It doesn't mean that they're happy with Russia. I think people don't understand the level of animosity that exists on many Georgians, especially those from Abkhazia and Sukhumi, towards Russia. Not the Russia of today, but just Russia because of what happened in 1992. when the Russian military actively sided with the Abkhaz rebels. My father-in-law, who I write about in the article, you know, he has a hole in his back from a Russian airplane. The Russian artillery shells blew out his eardrums. And it was...
I think he said he was 62 years old when he was called.
He got drafted. Yeah. 62, defending a bridge. Fired the last round. I mean, you know, he's not bragging about it, but he came up and the bridge was, you know, they're trying to hold off the rebels from closing the bridge. Now there's still some families who are running across. And, you know, he found one last magazine of ammunition and was able to take cover behind the... I mean, I know the area well because their house, literally, the bridge is here. Their house is right there. The apartment's right there. He's watching his apartment being captured by the enemy, watching everything about his home gone. And yet he's firing one more magazine to try and suppress the people so that last family can get across. And if you didn't get across, you died. And that's just the reality of it. And so it's a deeply personal thing. I know there's people out there in a lot of comments, you know, well, the Georgians weren't perfect. No shit, Sherlock. Read the article. I mean, I'm sick and tired of these dipshits sticking their nose where you know, either you're a fucking expert about Georgia or you're not. And if you're not, shut the fuck up and read and learn. You know, when I tell you that I'm angry with the Mehedrioni, do you even know what the Mehedrioni is? The horsemen? These guys.
That whole time you were going on, I could mention this town, that town, this town, that town, and my neighbors wouldn't even know. And I'm going, yep, that's me. Yep.
That's
right. I can't even say it again now that I just heard you say it.
But all these guys are sitting there going, you know, the Georgians made mistake. The Georgians did. I said, no kidding. I'm as angry at the Mehedrioni as I am at anybody else. Those dipshits, those criminals, those rapists, those thugs, those murderers came in, stormed in, and they took what could have been a political resolution to find a way to peacefully coexist under the sovereignty of the Georgian nation, and they ruined it. They came in there like thugs. They killed people. They pushed the Abkhaz out, and the majority of the Abkhaz who didn't want war now were forced to side with the radical group that was looking for a fight. Look, there were some Abkhaz looking for a fight. There were Georgians looking for a fight. But the vast majority of these people grew up neighbors, frickin' neighbors. I mean, I'm talking break bread neighbors, marry neighbors, the kind of neighbors that, you know, there are no secrets kind of neighbors. And the last thing they wanted was this civil war. And yet that's what the extreme Abkhaz gave them. That's what the Mehedrioni gave them. You know, and then this is what you get, the final defenders of the Council of Ministers. A hold up in the building. They surrender in defense of the Abkhaz. They didn't do this. This was done by other North Caucasian mountain people. They behaved disgracefully. These people were given assurances that they would be taken prisoner and exchanged. And instead, they were put on a bus driven behind the building, machine gunned down. But that's okay. I mean, that's what happened when you surrender to these forces. Anyways. Enough is enough. I get a little angry about this, but it's...
Yeah, well, you're entitled. You're entitled. One thing you just cleared up for me, and I had the impression, not that you intentionally misled anybody at all, because you didn't make this claim, but I had the impression from what you said the other night that these demonstrators were just, you know, some fringe group, and they didn't really represent how most Georgians feel. But if I heard you correctly a couple of minutes ago, you were saying it's actually a very divisive issue, because, you know, sometimes demonstrators... anywhere about any issue, sometimes they're just the loudest. They don't necessarily represent what a lot of people say.
The Georgian, look, you know, the fact of the matter is the ruling party, you know, is not pro NATO. They're not anti-NATO. They're just not ready to jump into this conflict. They're realistic about their relationships with Russia. And they were elected by a majority of the vote. But the president is the opposite. The president is, you know, a U.S., you know, pro-U.S., pro, there it is, Salom Zurabishvili. You know, here's the deal. Georgia, when the Soviet Union collapsed, was a very poor country, very poor country. And they don't have much going for it, but, you know, history, culture, and some agriculture. There's no heavy industry worthy of the name. And so they are totally dependent. There it is, Kinkali and Khachapuri, Adjarya Khachapuri. But the Georgians, they were desperate for survival, I guess. And they were feeling very beleaguered, embattled by the, you know, loss of South Ossetia and the loss of Abkhazia, a poor nation now compelled to absorb 350,000, internal refugees, people who are homeless. And there's a poverty-stricken country that can't take care of them. And so they're desperate for help. And the United States steps up, as we always do, but not to help, to buy. We're saying, hey, here's the dollar, but here's what you got to do. And, you know, one of the things that Georgia had to do in taking the dollar was send its young men off to fight and die in Iraq and Afghanistan. Georgians dying in Iraq. Georgians dying in Afghanistan. Why? Why? There's no reason for that. None. Except that they were paying the blood price necessary to be considered for NATO membership. They were extended invitation in 2008, just like the Ukrainians were. The Russians weren't happy about this. A lot of people forget, you know, that in August 2008, again, I talked about it in the article. I don't want to rehash too many, but the Russians were in good faith negotiating with Saakashvili in the lead up, you know, in the summer of 2008 about the conditions under which Abkhazia and Georgia, you know, could come back, some sort of federation agreement, et cetera, you know. But Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, flew in and put an end to that and whispered something in Saakashvili's ear. Next thing you know, he's sending his tanks into South Ossetia. They're shelling the Russian peacekeepers in their barracks. And the Russians got pissed off and showed them what's what. 5 days later, the Georgians are begging for peace. Another 180 Georgians dead, over 1,170 wounded. For what? To do what America wanted to do, become a point of instability, a center of chaos, to help bring down the Russian Empire. Well, the Russian Empire ain't going anywhere. First of all, it's not an empire. The Russians don't want to occupy Georgia. They don't want to control Georgia. They just don't want Georgia to invite NATO, an openly hostile military alliance, right up to the Russian borders. And they think that they would be in a better position to be a good neighbor to Georgia if North Georgia was a good neighbor to Russia. And good neighbors don't bring in the thieves in the night to ransack. But anyways, long story short, that's where we are.
All right. Speaking of a long story, there it is. Farewell, Sokoumi. Notice I'm pronouncing it the way you said is the Georgian way to pronounce it, right? Farewell, right. Sokoumi. And as many readers commented, it's a fascinating history lesson. And Scott gets into a lot of Georgian culture. We showed you some of the food. And Scott, whenever we talk about adult beverages, you always say, you don't know anything about wine. You're a beer guy. But in this article, you're pretty much waxing poetic about Georgian wine. What's up with that? All of a sudden, you're a wine guy, huh? How'd that happen? When did that happen?
Marina's father had got his doctorate in wine growing. And Georgia is a nation with the oldest, according to Georgians. I'm sure there's other people out there. Now, we're older than you. But bottom line is their wine making traditions go way back. They use something called a kveri, which is a huge clay pot that they put under the ground, and that's where they ferment the grapes and produce the wine. It's an ancient technique that's still used today to produce wine that, as I mentioned in the article, back in 1880 something, won the gold prize at the European Wine Festival. That's like the Catalina wine mixer. But it was, do you know the reference that I'm talking about?
No.
Catalina wine mixer?
No.
The movie with Will Ferrell and the brothers, brother-in-law.
Sorry, didn't see it. I just watched PBS documentaries. So, you
know. Well, you're smarter than I am. I watch stupid movies. Yeah. But but the bottom line is it's a tradition. He if you ever come visit us, we have grapes. We're growing grapes because Bidzina was that he grew two things better than anybody else. One was tomatoes. He patented several varieties of tomatoes and lost the patent when he, of course, when they had to flee Georgia. So he came back here. He came to the United States and went out and would painstakingly go through and pick tomatoes and then grow them. And then he would do the old genetic splicing where you splice the plants together to get another one. And he would just splice till he recreated the texture, the taste, everything that he wanted in his old tomatoes. And he got the three things back up again. Then he died, unfortunately. And Marina and I have his seeds, and we tried to plant them. We can't plant them at all. So
it's not easy. Huh?
We're pretty awesome. But with the grapes. Once you have grapes in the ground, if they've taken, they just, you know, you just cut them back every year, and they come back, and they make grapes. We eat them. But those were wine growing grapes that he had. We never did do a vintage. That was especially. So he's the one we took him, just a quick story since you brought Benzina up. We took him out to California. We were going through Napa Valley, you know, one of those big, Mondavi wineries or whatever. And so we come into the front, Benzina's get the front where the tourists are supposed to go, where they have the grapes laid out so the tourists can walk through and take the pictures.
Right.
And he's sitting there looking at it, and he's going, "These are garbage. This is crap. They don't use this to make wine. This is a tourist trap." Next thing I know, we're wandering into the real vineyard where no one's allowed to go. And Benzina's down on the ground. And all of a sudden, these security guys come out with this dude in the suit, and they're watching. Benzina's on the ground with the soil, tasting the soil, taking the leaves, taking it, you know, and all that stuff. And they're kind of going, "What's he doing?" I said, "Well, he makes wine. This is his thing. He's from Georgia." And they're like, "No kidding." Suddenly, we got taken into the back room, and we got the non-tour of how they actually do it. And he was talking to him about the soil. He was telling them that by tasting it, you know, the pH. And so they went out and they tested it. And what he was saying is that it's a little too high in pH, the soil, because just from tasting it. They're like, "Wow. No. We balance that all the time." They came out and tested the soil. It's exactly what he said, but he did it.
Oh my God. So
that's the kind of guy he was.
That's a great story. Well, I don't know if I'll ever get to see what's growing in your backyard, but we are going to be visiting together in Texas at the end of the month. And that is when you are supposed to make good on the bet that we made that you would be back on Twitter.
I thought it was just
for a glass of wine versus a glass of beer. You were talking about bringing me a bottle of Georgian wine. And the thing is, you got to check your baggage to bring wine. I don't want you to check your baggage just to bring me a bottle of wine. So,
well, we'll see if I can find a bottle of Stalin's favorite Kara, I'll bring it for you so you can get drunk like Stalin.
Whatever. Just know that I don't want you to check your bag just for me.
Well, I may go to Ryan and find out if they can sell that wine there. We'll just, yeah.
Okay, so every Tuesday we do the lightning round of Ask the Inspector. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Let's get to the questions from our beloved audience, starting with David John, much like me, two first names. He's an expat in Germany. Scott, I read your article on Georgia with a heavy heart. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Since the Georgian parliament has caved in to the mob, how do you see this being played out?
Well, I don't know if they caved into the mob. That's a little cynical. This was a setup. I mean, if you take a look at it, the demonstrations took place. The people that were doing the demonstrations were all basically, really got it. People who had taken the U.S. dollar, people who were, you know, on the USAID, you know, money wagon. And notice one of the first things that the United States did is, they told the Georgian government, even though these demonstrators are throwing Molotov cocktails and causing violence, that you can't violently suppress these. Now, last time I checked, we never told the French you can't beat the crap out of somebody in Paris. We never told the Dutch you can't stomp somebody in Amsterdam. You know, we normally don't get involved when our fellow democracies beat the shit out of people. But here in Georgia, do not violently suppress this. Why? Because they were doing the bidding of the United States. This is why Samantha Power, the head of USAID, spoke out. This is why another senior U.S. diplomat went to Georgia and said, "This law is bad. This law is the exact same law we have, Foreign Agency Registration Act." I mean, basically, if you take 20% of your funding from a foreign government, you got to tell us that you're doing it so we have transparency. It's what makes a democracy, but nope. Georgians can't do it because they'll find out that America is given far more than 20%. We're reshaping the country from the bottom up. So the Georgian government avoided violence. And, you know, violence is a tough one because the U.S. government has been training the Georgian army for the last, you know, 10 years or so. And, you know, many of those officers are loyal to the United States, maybe not loyal to Georgia. The last thing you want is a civil war. So they did the right thing. They backed down. But now look what's happened. Now that they backed down, and again, I don't want to get in too much trouble here, but Georgia got in a little bit of trouble last year sometime when there was a gay pride parade and the Georgian conservatives came out and said, ain't going to happen in our city. Now, I'm not saying that's good for America, but I'm saying we shouldn't be telling the Georgians how to think. Small nation, very insular, conservative, family values, all that kind of stuff. They stomped that down. I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying that's what they did. And that's one of the things that's happening here is we have this cultural divide. You have a lot of Georgians that aren't happy about diversity and LGBTQ and all this kind of stuff that we're promoting with a heavy hand. And today there was a big demonstration of these conservative Georgians coming out and saying, no, that's not who we are. That's not what we are. That's not what we want. That's not the vision of our Georgia. And that demonstration wouldn't have happened if the Georgian parliament hadn't, you know, backed out. So I think the Georgian parliament is playing a bigger political game than simply passing one law. Everybody knows what's going on. Everybody knows all of those NGOs were taking the American dollar. And now it's all out in the open. And I think you're going to see Georgian conservative Georgia stepping up and doing it. But it's a dangerous time. There's a Georgian legion in Ukraine that was brought in these Ukrainian fighters, and they were getting ready to go off and provoke a fight with the Abkhazian and South Ossetians. Dangerous time.
Sergey from Vladivostok, Russia. How do you see your book tour through Mother Russia? I live in the far east of Russia and would love for you to stop by.
Well, Sergey, let me tell you, buddy, Vladivostok is on the list. So if it goes down as planned, there will be an event there, and I certainly hope to see you then.
All right. Maybe you can enjoy a bottle of Georgian wine with him. Who knows? They have Georgian restaurants throughout Russia, right?
They do, everywhere. Yeah.
All right. Next, we go to Baltic Mollusk from the Crimean shores. Should Georgia and Armenia apply to join the Russian Federation?
No. Nah. Georgia is an independent nation. Armenia is an independent nation. They're sovereign peoples. They don't need to be part of the Russian Federation. I don't know if Russia wants them as part of the Russian Federation. But I think Russia would like to have them as, you know, part of a, you know, economic union. There can be some sort of union arrangement with Russia, you know, so that they are economically cooperating with one another. That'd be to the benefit of Georgia. I think there can be political coordination on foreign policy, because foreign policy impacts economic policy. You know, I have no problem with Georgia, you know, becoming close to Russia and becoming part of the Russian orbit, as it is geopolitically natural for Georgia to do. It's not natural for Georgia to be in the American geopolitical orbit. It's sort of natural to be in. That doesn't mean that American Georgians can't be friends. Georgia, that's why Georgia should be independent. That way it can do what it wants to do. Russia's made it clear it has no problem, or at least it had no problem with nations who want to join the European Union. Feel free. I mean, but you're joining a sinking ship. You know, the Russians and the Chinese right now have this thing called the Trans-Eurasian Economic Union that's taken off. And the last time I checked, Georgia's sort of closer to that part than they are to the European part. And they might do better having very good relations with Russia. That doesn't mean you have to turn your back on Europe. There's no reason for that. But there's nothing that says you can't be friends and good neighbors to everybody. You don't have to pick sides. And that's why I think it'd be better for Georgia to be an independent nation. And same thing with Armenia. You know, Armenia's playing a dangerous game, trying to walk away from the, you know, the CSTO, which is a military alliance right now, while they're picking a fight with Azerbaijan. You know, you might find out what it means to be truly alone, and that's not a good thing when the big neighbor to your south in the east and the west is Turkey. Armenia and Turkey don't have a history of very good relations. So, you know, being a friend with Russia, you know, has its perks.
Next, we go to Bulgaria and Ilyan Stanchev. Who's ever in charge of these things should make a bigger distinction between the capital I and lowercase l. Can you work on that for me, Scott? You're the weapons inspector.
Oh, I'm working on it, yeah.
Yeah, I always find that disturbing. Just how damaging was Hollywood's superficial representation of Russia and Russians for all these years for today's perceptions of Americans about Russia?
Well, I mean, one only has to look at the Sunday night's Oscars and the documentary that won, Navalny. I mean, just a total absurdity, pure propaganda, garbage documentary film. But it won the Oscar. They wine, dine, feted. And most Americans watching are saying, yeah, that's an accurate representation of what's going on. Navalny's the man, Putin's evil, et cetera, et cetera. This is just, you know, it's typical of how we've done this. I mean, I'm thinking about writing a, you know, I haven't written it because I, you know, I don't like to air too much dirty laundry of the country and the public, but Navalny's a CIA asset and I can prove it, you know, and it's very easy to prove. I wouldn't be giving away classified information. You just have to look at what's there and you realize, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 and 2 + 2 = 4. And Navalny works for the CIA. And yet we ignore that. We pretend he's some sort of, you know, voice of democracy. He's not. He may have been at one point in time when he first started out in his anti-corruption, but when he was taken into that Columbia Fellowship, when he came to the United States, and next thing you know, he's got a U.S. intelligence agent, you know, community mentor who's advising him. Advising, that means you're going out to dinner with the CIA guys from the, you know, certain branch, certain division, who's talking to you about what your future things, how they're going to pay you, how the money's going to come in, how you can communicate, all the trade craft. Navalny's a spy. He's lucky he's alive. In the old days, he used to shoot spies. Right now, the Russians, I guess they don't want to give away their sources and methods of how they know how bad this guy is. So they got him on corruption charges. But he's a spy. He's horrible. An American would never tolerate an American doing for Russia what we tolerate Navalny doing for us. It's a double standard. Okay, I'm not saying that we have to bow down and kowtow to Russia and all that. No, but we have to treat a traitor as a traitor, you know, and we have to recognize what he is. He has betrayed Russia. He's not a great guy, and he's a liar. Everything about him is a lie. But anyways, no, you're right. Russophobia runs deep, and Hollywood is to blame.
Shane Martinez from El Paso, Texas. What do you think about the whole split in NATO and problems with shells for Ukraine and difficulties with tanks and artillery supply, et cetera, story? Is all this disinformation created by State Department paid opinion leaders in order to actually prepare a mighty attacking fist and inflict irreparable losses on Russia?
A mighty attacking fist and irreparable losses on Russia. Nah,
that's Shane Martinez. You know, they're poets in El Paso.
I'm telling you, man, he's got it. That is an epic poem in the making. I don't know. What do I think of the split in NATO? I don't know. Ask the Turks, ask the Greeks. Is there a split or is that manufactured? Ask the Germans, ask the Poles. Is there a split or is it manufactured? I mean, we just go on and on and on. What I think about the shell shortage? I don't know. Maybe there is a shell shortage. You know, they're not making it up. Nobody has any shells left. We've given them all away. So we can go on and on. No, this is the truth. This is basically what happens when you overcommit, when you double down on stupid, then triple down on stupid, and then quadruple down on stupid. You get stupid results. So I don't see, of course, this time next week, the mighty fist is going to hit Russia and they're going to collapse. Everybody's going, Ritter, you got it wrong. Okay, if that happens, I'll eat my tie. But until then, I'll stick with the assessments that I put out.
All right, Shane, we're coming to your state at the end of the month. Come see us. I know El Paso is about 8 hours away. Stop halfway, get yourself a sandwich. You'll enjoy the trip. And then we can see who has a greater way with words, you or the weapons inspector.
Shane, we know the answer.
All right, next we're going to go to Daniel, my brother. You are older than me. Do you still feel the pain? The Anti-Defamation League supports Ukraine, not Russia. If the Ukraine leadership are actually Nazis, do you really believe the ADL would support them?
Well, what I do know is that there's some pretty credible Jewish organizations that do believe the Ukrainian leadership are Nazis, including the chief rabbi of Ukraine and others. The ADL is a horrific organization. They're a hate organization. They're supposed to be an anti-defamation league organization. That's not what they do. They defame everybody else. How could they possibly side with Ukraine? How could they possibly? If there's anybody from the ADL listening right now, come on this show and let's have it out, guys. Stepan Bandera, really? I mean, according to Zelensky, he's pretty cool. He's not cool. He's a mass murderer. We can go on and on and on and on about how bad Ukraine is, how anti-Semitic they are. But he's a Jewish president. Well, you know, there were Jews working for the Nazis in the concentration camps too, ADL. And you know that. We call them capos. So Zelensky is a modern day capo. He's selling his fellow Jews down the road to an anti-Semitic far right, Ukrainian nationalist organization that has never liked the Jews. All they've done is kill the Jews. And now you want to pretend that because a Jew is president controlled by them, that somehow they've changed their stripes. Think again, if they were to win, they're not going to, thank goodness. But if they were, you'd be up against the wall, guys. You would be, because they don't like you. They hate you. They despise you. You're subhuman. Why do I know that? Because they're Nazis. And that's how the Nazis felt about the Jews too. But you seem to have forgotten that, ADL. No, the ADL disgusts me. Bam, off with them.
Anti-defamation league.
All they do is defame people. We're going to get in trouble for that one, but that's okay.
Oh, how will we ever cope with controversy? I'm already crumbling. Jafar from France, you often say that the West doesn't listen to what Russians are saying. Putin, in multiple occasions, clearly states that he intends to have this war last for years. Don't you think on a strategic level, a long-lasting war would drain NATO's countries financially, militarily, and economically?
Putin has never said on any occasion that he intends to have this war last for years. That's just an absurdity, Jafar. I don't know what you're saying. Putin has made it clear he didn't want this war. What the hell do you think the whole Minsk agreements were about, the Minsk Accords? Why was Russia the only one seeking peace if they intended to have a war that lasted for years? No, this is the West that intends to have wars that last for years. Putin might be saying that the West intends to have wars that last for years, but that doesn't mean that Russia wants wars to last for years. Russia wants a rapid termination of this. Why was Russia the only one that was serious about the 1 April peace agreement if they wanted the war to last for years? No, that's insane. Putin is ready to fight this war. But he's not good. You know, I mean, if they want to make this a war that lasts for years, Russia's not wilting. They're not going to run away. But the last thing Russia wants is conflict. If you think that's the case, you don't know anything about Vladimir Putin. He's not the warmonger that George W. Bush was. He's not the warmonger that Barack Obama was. He's not the warmonger that Donald Trump was. He's definitely not the warmonger that Joe Biden is. He's a man who has sought the peaceful solution at every step of the way. What about Syria? Gosh, I think he was invited into that country. Invited why? Because we were trying to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria using, jihadists, Al-Qaeda, the irony of America, attacked by Al-Qaeda, global war on terror, Now we're siding with Al-Qaeda to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. So Assad reaches out to the Russians and says, help. And the Russians go to help. That's a far cry from the kind of crap we pull in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. No, Putin's not looking for a long war. He'll fight one if necessary, but he's not looking for it. That's the antithesis of what he stands for. He stands for, economic opportunity and peaceful coexistence.
Yeah. It's a commonly used persuasion tactic where somebody will want to express their opinion, which is, totally unlettered and baseless, but they'll say, obviously, it's clearly this or that. And it's like, really? Because you say it's clearly, or they ratchet up the indignation. It's like, the opinion is unassailable. Okay, whatever. Justin from Dublin, occupied Ireland. Okay, Justin, if you say so. You say this war will be over this summer. Pretend you're a neocon. How would you drag this war out another year without causing World War III?
First thing I do is I wouldn't sacrifice 20, 30, 40, 50,000 troops in Bakhmut. So there's that. I'd get out of Bakhmut. I'd consolidate my reserves. And then I'd encourage the Ukrainians to begin a slow, painful fighting withdrawal. I'd pick a line that we're going to defend on, maybe the Dnieper River. But I wouldn't give up terrain easily. I'd make the Russians pay. I'd make them come in and I'd yield. If they overextend, I'd punch them with a brigade here. I'll punch them with a brigade there until the Russians find out that it's fall now And now they're up on the Dnieper River, but they don't have a chance to get over the Dnieper River. And so now we've solidified that defensive line. And then I'm praying for the West to start kicking in that defense industry thing. All those artillery shells I ran out of need to start coming in. And now we fight a war of attrition on the Dnieper River. And that's how I could make this thing last another year. Fortunately, Zelensky doesn't think that way. And whoever's advising him isn't telling him the right thing. And so he's going for the big battle in Bakhmut. You're going to burn through all his reserves. When that you're going to burn through his artillery shells. When that happens, the Russians, war's over in summer. It ain't going to be easy. When I do this, that doesn't imply that it's easy. That's just my way of saying 10,000 Russians die, 400,000 Ukrainians die. A lot of people are going to die. There's a lot of fighting left. It's not, you know, by any sense of the imagination going to be, you know, over as a piece of cake. There's some grinding to do, dying to do, suffering to do, crying to do.
Okay. Ziga from Austria, what's your opinion on the recent flight of an American bomber, which was supposed to simulate an attack on St. Petersburg, maybe a nuclear attack? Is this a routine training?
We used to pull this stunt during the Cold War. We used to, you know, Navy would do it, and the Far East Air Force would do it over Europe. But you fly a nuclear attack profile, but you do it at an altitude that everybody knows, because normally if you're going to fly a nuclear attack profile, you can be a little bit lower under the radar, a lot of jamming going on and all that kind of crap. But this time you come up and you do it, because first thing you want to do is just, I can guarantee you what was flying along with that B-52 orbiting over here were a couple of RC-135s and some other aircraft, and some satellites were turned on, because what you want to do is ping, 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 get the Russians to light everything up. You come in, you do that little push, and then you turn around, but you fly the profile so it's not an even turn. You make everybody know that that was a push. It was a push towards St. Petersburg, and you come away. It is literally the dumbest thing in the world for us to be doing at this point in time. Whoever came up with that should be fired, except probably people approved it. It is stupidity in the extreme. You know, all it takes is one mistake, guys. One mistake, one miscalculation. And you don't know, you know, what's going on in the minds of Russian, you know, radar operators. You don't know what other pressures are on in the command center. And suddenly this happens, something else happens. Maybe you have a, you know, because the military is dumber than dirt sometimes, and they don't fully coordinate. So you pull this stunt while another stunt happens down here that you weren't aware of. And now the Russians feel like two stunts are happening at the same time, and they overreact. And then stuff happens. So, no, this is stupidity in the extreme. This is why we have to get arms control back on the tables, so stupidity like this never happens again. There's no reason for us to be flying a profile, a strike profile against St. Petersburg. Hey, all you idiots out there that think that's a good idea, go visit St. Petersburg. Go visit Peterhof. Go visit the art. Look at the culture here. These are the Russians. These are the guys you denigrate as, you know, vodka-drinking fools. They got more culture in their little pinky than you do. All right? Go visit them and then tell me you want to attack that. You wouldn't want to attack that. You'd want to preserve it. Next.
Hoo-ah!
Blob from the United Kingdom, specifically Wales. There is a large amount of U.S. military equipment in the port of Gdynia, maybe, in Poland, just sitting there unprotected. Could that be a kind of a bait for Russia to bomb it all for nothing, thus provoking the U.S. like the U.S. provoked Japan to attack Pearl Harbor?
It's a brigade's worth of equipment. It seems like a lot, but it's not a lot. It's part of the rotational force. I think those guys are going home. So they're sitting there in the port, you say unprotected, but there's nothing to protect them from. We're not war with Russia. But then we're not asking the Russians to attack us. Those guys are clearing customs. There might have to be some agricultural inspections going in where they have to spray the stuff down. Why would Russia do that? If Russia wants to destroy a brigade of American equipment, then let the brigade pivot, head towards Russia, and destroy it on the battlefield. Why would Russia want to be the ones that start a war like that? There's nothing to gain from this. To destroy a brigade's worth of equipment and what, put your nation at war? You guys do understand that the United States packs a heavy punch. I know I sit here and I talk about the capabilities of the Russian military, but we ain't weak. All right? We may not be able to roll over Russia, but we will hurt the hell out of Russia. They'll hurt us too. But the concept that Russia's going to get a free freaking ride by going to war with America, are you high? There'll be so much death and destruction dealt to Russia, you wouldn't begin to even understand it. Russia would wake up one morning and shit would be gone. Shit would be gone. So why would anybody in Russia say that's a good idea? It's not a good idea. It's a horrible idea. Just let the United States do what it's doing right now, guys. You're winning, and you don't have to do anything. I mean, you want financial collapse? Shit, just, man, let's watch the banks go, baby. You don't have to do anything. I know we're going to blame it on Putin, because obviously Putin infiltrated the Silicon Valley Bank and was getting them to go into bad investments. You just have to sit back and watch. Look at the PPP, which is the something purchasing power of the BRICS nations. I forget what the first P is, but it's the real purchasing power as opposed to the dollar figure, what it really translates into. BRICS just surpassed the G7. G7 on a downward trajectory, BRICS on an upward trajectory. Last time I checked BRICS, the R in BRICS is for Russia. That means you're on the right path. So basically just don't do anything to America. Let us beat ourselves. Don't empower us. Don't awaken us by carrying out a Pearl Harbor attack against, you know, a couple thousand vehicles in a Polish port as they're ready to go home, of all things.
Take a deep breath, Scott. It's okay. In fact, you know how I ask you to pronounce Russian names. You just relax. I think I can pronounce this.
You got this one? Okay.
I know a little Spanish. Ooh. Tomas Landere Castellanos from Albacete, Spain. How's that? I think that's correct. Do you know Article 16 of the Ukraine Constitution? It says at the end, it is the duty of the state to keep the genetic pool of the people of Ukraine. In the words of Nazi Germany, it was to keep the purity of the white race. What are your thoughts, Scott Ritter?
There's nothing to say. You pretty much laid it out there. I mean, the Ukrainians obviously, you know, now the question is, which genetic pool and which people of Ukraine are we talking about? Because the last time I heard, they're doing the primary genetic testing in Western Ukraine, in Lvov, in that area, and that what they're looking for is no taint of Russian Slavic blood, pure Galician Ukrainians. So that law, if that's the strict interpretation, and it is, that means that all the ethnic Russians aren't real Ukrainians. They're not this. And now, what happens when you finally have to acknowledge that? If you ain't pure, you ain't Ukrainian. Well, what are you? Russian? That's sort of what Vladimir Putin said. So, you know, the Ukrainians are stupid. I'm sorry. I have no problem with preserving Ukrainian culture. I think that's wonderful. I think, but you don't steal Russian culture in the process. If it's, you know, if it's something that identifies to the Ukrainian nation that is recognized historically in terms of a time period, it's yours, man. Own it. If it's part of your history going back when maybe you were part of the Russian Empire or something else, you can own that too, but have to acknowledge the reality of it. You know, and your religion, no one's sitting here saying that, you know, you have to worship the way the Russians do. If you have your own unique church, a real church, and there's Catholics, pray, worship. No one's stopping you.
Scott, I poked around the internet a bit. And I saw that in fact is in the Constitution. There's slight variations on how it's worded, but they're all pretty much the same. But I also saw some people defending it, and I don't quite understand. I just want to know if you're aware of this explanation, that it has to do, the context of it has to do with surviving the Chernobyl disaster. I still don't understand why they would put it in those terms, but are you aware of that explanation?
I'm aware of that explanation.
Is it total bullshit, or is there some validity to that?
I'd have to go back and look at the legislative history of that amendment when it came in. I think there's some legitimacy to the origins of it, mm-hmm. but like any law, you can pass a law thinking it means one thing, but then how it's done is another. And the way it's not being pursued today to preserve, you know, the genetic purity of the Ukrainian race in a post apocalyptic world. It's that's done basically to keep Jews out of Ukrainian blood, to keep Russians out of Ukrainian blood, to keep Poles out of Ukrainian blood. That's what it's being done for. I don't, you know, how it came into being, we can talk about that, but how it's being implemented, totally different thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's still, even if it does pertain to the Chernobyl disaster, it's, it still seems very odd wording, although, you know, it's a different language. So I don't know.
Right. My wife says that it's the translation. So you guys are reading the English version of the Ukrainian. It was meant to be referring to Chernobyl, but as Scott says, that's not the way it's being used now.
Yeah. Well, even in the translation, it does refer to Chernobyl, as mentioned, because there's more language in Article 16 than just that part of it. So, you know, even that is making it to the translation, but still don't quite get it. That's Kevin, the voice of Kevin Michelizzi backstage. By the way,
I thought this was one of your, you know, Al Pacino things. I'm like, okay, I'm not placing this clip. I'm not placing this clip.
That was Kevin live, and he is curating some live questions that we'll get to. Why don't we get to it right after this one, actually? Questions coming in live on YouTube and Facebook. And thanks to Kevin for helping us out, as he always does, staying up real late in Crimea. Fu from Chicago. How significant is the peace deal China just brokered between mortal enemies Saudi Arabia and Iran? Is it setting off alarm bells in Turkey, Israel, and Washington?
It's a game changer, literal game changer. It's definitely sending off alarm bells in Israel and Washington. I don't know about Turkey so much. But it's basically, you know, our big thing is the, you know, we've created something we call the Shia Crescent, which is basically Iran's malign activities that stretch from Lebanon through Syria, through Iran, through Iraq, into Afghanistan, then down into, you know, through Saudi Arabia, Eastern Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and then Yemen. And this is where Iran's putting its dirty little fingers and everything and causing trouble. Except it's not. It's just that's Iran is a big nation in a neighborhood, and it has an interest in places that have significant Shia populations. On the opposite end of Iran is Saudi Arabia, and recently, because of the Abrams Accord, Israel finding common cause to build up a Gulf alliance to confront the Iranians along this Shia crescent. And Saudi Arabia has been involved in all the problems. Yeah, you take a look at Lebanon, the problems there with Lebanon. Saudi money is all over the place. Syria, what started the Syrian civil war, was Saudi stepping in the aftermath of a drought and building villages, rebuilding them, putting up mosques, and putting their own Wahhabist clerics in there to revolutionize the youth, to radicalize them. Iraq, Saudi money pouring into there. Saudis are promoting, you know, anti-theocratic groups in Iran, in Yemen, the war in Yemen. So right off the bat, these are the two major parties for this crescent of crisis, so to speak. And we're, America's the ones that promote it, and Israel wants to promote it too. So what the Chinese just did is brought that to a screaming halt. Not a screaming halt yet. There's a lot of work left to be done. But hey, if you have, you know who doesn't have an embassy in Saudi Arabia? Israel. And Israel's like, what the hell? You just made peace with our enemy. When the Saudis are going, well, they ain't the enemy anymore. You see, because both of us, Saudi Arabia and Iran, are going to join BRICS and the Shanghai group and all this other stuff together. Game changer. And if you can get Saudi Arabia and Iran to agree on stability in Lebanon, stability in Syria, stability in Yemen, stability in Iraq, suddenly you have peace. And it's a peace that the United States isn't involved in. So we're nervous about this too, because this undercuts us. Our sole purpose, though, what gives our foreign policy any sort of relevance nowadays, is the violence and the death and destruction that we generate, the chaos, and that we take advantage of that. The Chinese have just come in and done the exact opposite. It's the anti-chaos. It's called stability. And it's a game-changing event.
Okay, that's it for the questions submitted in advance. Kevin Michelizzi, by the way, has a new podcast that he's doing with his co-host, Deborah Armstrong, great independent journalist who's another friend of the show. And you can find it on YouTube at that address. And we will now call on Kevin curation skills to present some questions coming in live on YouTube and Facebook from our beloved audience. Dr. Caring, great name, and thanks for the donation. How many other retired U.S. officers, as a percentage, do you think share your open-minded truth-seeking? 42%.
I don't know. I mean, I'd be making a number up. I can tell you this. I get a lot of people who are retired military officers reaching out and saying, good job. And I get a lot of people who are retired military officers reaching out and calling me all sorts of vile names. Traitor, you know, asshole. You know, so maybe we'll say 50%, but that's even wrong. I don't know. I can't put a, because the vast majority of military officers are quiet, silent. You know, they did their duty and now they've retired and, you know, they spent a career not being political. And so they keep their opinions to themselves. So I don't know what the vast majority of them think.
Yeah. Good answer to a question that's ultimately unanswerable. Unverified Bear, thanks for the donation. Given what is known about the Nord Stream attacks, is it wise for NATO to encourage Germany to spend $100 billion? Well, I don't know what that is. That's another
euro
rearming, considering who their anger may be directed at in coming years. My endless kudos and gratitude to you both. Thank you.
Well, I mean, NATO needs to encourage Germany to do that because NATO needs you know, all NATO nations to step up and expand their percentage of GDP that they are going to allocate towards the military. They need to rearm to make their military viable from a NATO perspective. And if Germany doesn't take the lead, then it's setting a precedent for other nations not to take it seriously. So it's absolutely essential from a NATO perspective that Germany step up. But as you pointed out, there's a whole host of reasons why Germany shouldn't and maybe won't step up. One, the German economy is not doing as great as everybody thinks it is, and it's going to cost them a heck of a lot more than 100. That 100 billion euro was a figure thrown out, you know, last year around summertime, I believe, maybe in the fall. But you know, this is pre, you know, Nord Stream being blown up and the world coming to hell. Right now, that number is going to be even higher. Look, the Minister of Defense just had to fire the Inspector General of the German military because he's telling the truth. First truth he's told is, we got nothing, boss. You gave it all away. We don't even have enough helmets for our own troops. We don't have enough rifles for our own troops. We don't have enough flak jackets for our own troops because you gave it all away to the Ukrainians. And we can't afford to replace them because everything's gone up in price. And then the next thing he said was the Ukrainians are going to lose because they sort of suck at what they're doing right now. They're not that good. You know, they're rapidly mobilizing. The troops are sending in aren't well trained. They can't handle the equipment we've given them and they're dying. And so rather than deal with the truth coming from a man who's paid, that's what inspector generals are supposed to do. Tell the truth. They fired him. So who knows where Germany's going to go? But I have a feeling that Germany's not going to be spending 100 billion euro on this, that Germany's going to be taking a long, hard look at, you know, where it needs to be in terms of, you know, European, you know, geopolitics, and the military may not be the number one spending priority going forward.
Okay. Xenia is, while I'm bragging about pronouncing her name, now I'm going to get stuck. Is Nizhny Novgorod on your Russian tour list?
It isn't, but it doesn't mean it can't be. I can nominate it and see what they say. I'm not in control of the list. I have made some suggestions, I mean, I'm already going there for like 25 days, so it's a long trip. And but hey. I understand it's a beautiful city with some great, great culture. And if it's a city that the Russian publisher believes they can sell books in, they might foot the bill to add another city to the tour. So we'll give it a shot.
Mother Russia, she's a big country, huh?
It's a big country. I mean, you think, you know, flying from New York to LA and you're like, oh my God, that 5-hour flight. Try flying from Moscow to Vladivostok. You know, it's like, holy cow, that flight never ends.
All right. This might be the issue that I was discussing with Kevin. This, I think this happened a few hours ago. Is this what you were talking about, Kevin? What was the significance of the U.S. drone shot down in international waters in the Black Sea?
It is Reaper.
Yeah, MQ-8. What was the significance? First of all, it wasn't shot down. It was brought down. I know I'm playing words here, but one's a absolute act of war, and the other one is just the Russians. Look, here's the deal. Let's just be straight about this. The United States is flying intelligence assets all over the place and reporting the intelligence they gather back to the Ukrainians to then use it for targeting purposes. Straight up. I'd have to take a look at where this was flying, but my guess is that Reaper was in a position to gather intelligence information about Russian activities that the Russians weren't too thrilled about being passed on to the Ukrainians. So the word was, bring her down. And it was deliberate. They came in, they dumped fuel on it, an attempt to swamp the engine, get it to crash. That didn't work. So they came in, they clipped the propeller, took it down. And the Russians are sending a signal. No more free ride on the intelligence collection business, guys. Whatever the Russians are protecting, they didn't want the Reaper to be collecting on it and reporting it back to the Ukrainians. And remember, the Reaper has a real-time ground link. So there was probably that data that was collected was going straight to a intelligence fusion cell that had Ukrainians sitting in it, probably in Poland. And then they had a real-time link back to Odessa, and they were passing that information on, and then the Ukrainians could do stuff with it. So the Russians are saying, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And I think you're going to see more of this. I think the Russians are tired of giving NATO a free pass to collect intelligence and pass it on to the Ukrainians, because that means dead Russians. And no nation would accept that.
Okay, because we have over 4,200 people watching live now, and because we gabbed a little longer than usual at the beginning, I propose we extend the show a few minutes to squeeze in a few more questions. Is that okay with both Kevin and Scott?
From my perspective, I know you're being nice, Jeff, and pretending that I have a vote in this, but people should know that he controls me. He's a control freak, and when his suggestions aren't suggestions, they're actually orders. So, yes, sir, we'll stay on as long as you want, sir.
All right. I'm glad you know your place in this operation.
Yeah, that's right.
Dmitry Priyadiko, it would be great to be able to buy your signed book outside of the U.S. Yes, talk about who's in charge. I just emailed Scott about that, and I said, why don't we figure out a way to do that? So you're on the spot now, Scott, in the public.
Okay, there it is.
All right. You said in a recent episode you feel bad about charging people for the postage. And I said, okay, but do you feel good about people not being able to get the book?
No, you're right. Look, and here's the deal. Just so everybody knows, it costs a hell of a lot of money to mail a book overseas. And I can't do it. I mean, trust me, out of the kindness of my heart, I'd love to do it. I have sent easily a dozen books to Europe as gifts. And I don't mind $30 book. It's okay. $50 postage. Now, I'm not a math genius, but a dozen books at $50 each, we're getting up into some serious money. That's $600.
Yeah, but you're not being asked to pay for it. You're being asked to let me figure out what.
But my point is, no, that. But again, because I'm sitting there going, that's a ridiculous amount of money. But if you guys want to pay it to get my autograph on a book, A, I'm honored. And B, Jeff will find a way to make it happen.
All right. So coming soon. Thank you for your interest. And we're getting a lot of orders from the U.S., and you can go to scottrittermerch.com directly to order an autographed copy of Scott's book. This is an exclusive offer. And if you forget the URL, you can also link to it from our Substack, which is scottritterextra.com. But if you want to go straight to it, scottrittermerch.com. All right. Scott deferred to my authority and has agreed to stay on. This is a hostage situation.
Hostage situation.
Frank Nakai. Thank you, Frank, for the donation. Why are Ukrainians resisting so furiously? They were one country 30 years ago. Is Azov keeping soldiers in the field at gunpoint? Please explain.
You know, this is the million-dollar question. How do I answer this without throwing somebody under the bus? Let's put it this way. There's a lot of old Russian and Ukrainian ladies in this area who get stay-at-home health care kind of stuff. And so in the process, you get to meet, if you know somebody who took care of them, you get to meet the whole community, because it's all a community of Russian and Ukrainian women who do this. It's a big industry. And when you have when you come up to visit somebody and they go, shh, keep it down, they're all Banderists, meaning the ladies that are helping over there, they're Banderists. And this lady was afraid that if you said something that could stir up the Banderists. And this was before the war started. So there's this thing going. And if you talk to people, again, we are very close with the local community, and you talk to people, and the Jewish people tell you that there was a difference between the way they were treated by ethnic Russian Ukrainians and Western Ukrainians. And it's, there's a world of difference. And then what you're finding out is that Western Ukrainians were trained to hate Russians from the very beginning. I mean, even during Soviet times, Western Ukrainians were trained to hate Russians. And I tried to figure out the root cause of this. So I did some research. And what I found out is, there was this period of time. I'm going to run out of time. There's a period of time from 1945 to 1953 that the CIA backed this insurgency, the Bandera insurgency. When that ended, about 150,000 of them surrendered and were taken prisoner and put in the gulag for 25 years. But in 1956, they were released by Khrushchev, and there was no denazification. And they came back in, and they insinuated them back into Ukrainian society, and they became, community leaders, business leaders, etc. And they had this hatred towards all things Russia that was filled down. This is why Moskva is an insult. They call them orcs. The Ukrainians were trained to hate Russians. And so now you have a nation that they, honest to God, hate Russians. And that's why they're resisting so much. It makes no sense. But that's the reality, is that many of those Ukrainians view Russia as a threat. They dislike the Russians. They hate the Russians. They don't want to be friends with Russia. And so this war is more complicated than you think. Yes, there's a lot of, Russian-speaking Ukrainians who don't believe that way, but they've always been prejudiced against by the pure Western Ukrainians who hated them as much as they hated the Russians. If you spoke Russian, we come back to the DNA. If you got Russian Slavic stuff in you, you're a subhuman. Genetic purity, baby. So anyways, don't hit me with that second whip.
Okay, I stopped it just in the nick of time there. All right, let's do two more questions. What do you got, Kevin? Bob LeBlanc, where is a solid site to find true info on the Ukraine-Russia conflict? ScottRitterExtra.com.
No, I'm not even going to promote that. Look, this is the first casualty of war is the truth. And both sides are guilty of suppressing things or exaggerating things, diverting things. One side's more guilty of making shit up than the other. But the bottom line is, if you're sitting here from thousands of miles away, you can go with a gut assessment, but you can't sit here and say, I know exactly what's going on. This is why I've hesitated. People are like, Scott, you got to write a book. And I'm like, no, because I would never want to put my name to a book about this war, because there's no way I could guarantee that the next day an archive isn't going to open up and everything I assessed was wrong. There's just so much we have to learn about this war. And the longer this war goes on, it's the more I am learning about things. It turns out that most of what I'm learning sort of underscores the correctness of my overall assessment, but the details, and wars are won and fought in the details, and the details are out there. There's just not enough of them out there. So I can't sit here and pretend to tell you, go to this person, go to that person, go to this site, go to that site. That ain't how it's going to work, buddy. Here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to earn it, which means you need to go out there and you need to subscribe to different Telegram channels. You need to open up a Twitter account and follow people from all ideologies. You need to follow podcasts like the Duran. You need to follow Andrei Martyanov. You need to follow other people. You need to find, I mean, God forbid I say his name. Oh, but you need to follow Gary Tabak, because I hate everything about this man, but he represents the other side. So you can't fall victim or hostage to one person's point of view. If you claim you want to have the big picture, you got to follow it all. And then you've got to apply some logic, some methodology, some history, and sort through it all and come up with your own conclusions, until which time this war ends and people are able to gain access to at least a sufficient amount of archival data to write, you know, a responsible book about this war. I'm not going to put my name on a quick book. I don't do that. That's just bad. I've been bitten enough during this war making, you know, because people are like, Scott, what do you think? And then I'm stupid enough to go, well, this is what I think. And then unfortunately, you know, then a week later, it's like, you're dumber than dirt, because that's not what happened. No shit, Sherlock. No plan survives initial contact with the enemy. And, you know, I never said that I had a crystal ball. I'm giving you an assessment based upon limited data. You know, and sometimes you get it wrong. A lot of times you get it wrong. I'm not going to write a book that gets it wrong. If I write a book on this, it's going to be 10 years down the road when I can sit here and say definitively, this is what happened.
All right, let's do one more question and call it a show. Olivia. Hey. Oh, sorry, I forgot to stop the clock. You actually beat the clock. Sorry about that. Watching from Romania, how dangerous do you think the situation is in Transnistria? And is there a real risk that our country gets dragged into this war? This is our biggest worry.
Well, it is a legitimate worry, Olivia. I mean, it's, I mean, when you got the Moldovan president, you know, renaming the language of her nation to Romanian, and you have the Moldovan military actively working with the Romanian military at a time when the Moldovan prime minister is talking about, thanks, Justin, talking about,
Actually, we're going to add a donation option, so don't worry about it. We'll take care of that. Go ahead.
Jeff, always the businessman.
But options, baby. Life is about options.
You are the option man. But the point is, you got a prime minister says he can resolve the Transnistria issue, you know, militarily if necessary. So you have all this. You have the Ukrainians digging in, putting pressure on for a second front. It's real, and there's a real risk, because the moment all it takes is one mistake, one act of stupidity, and the whole thing goes off. The only thing that mitigates against this are the consequences, and I think the Romanians know the consequences. I think the Moldovans know the consequences, and the Ukrainians know the consequences. For Ukraine, the consequence is that Zelensky dies. He becomes a legitimate command and control target because it's no longer a special military operation. It becomes a war. For Moldova, the consequences are you cease to exist as the state that you currently have. Whether Russia destroys you or the pro-Russian population rises up and removes you from power. You know, and I have to tell you, if you want to, you know, engage in aggressive action against Russians, if I were the Russian government, if I were the Russian SVR and the FSB, I'd be actively working behind the scenes to get your ass tossed out. I mean, you become a legitimate target for active measures. I'm not promoting that. I'm just saying, if I were a Russian, you cooked your own stew and you decide to jump in the pot. So don't complain when the water stops boiling or starts boiling. And if I were Romania, understand this, a Moldovan adventure void of an Article 4 understanding with NATO doesn't give you any NATO protections. It just means that your troops are going to die. And the Romanian army has to ask itself straight up, are we ready for that? You know, when you have a 4-star American general saying NATO couldn't imagine what's going on right now in Ukraine in terms of the scope and scale of the violence, I can guarantee you that a Romanian general didn't imagine it either, because the Romanians are sitting there saying, bring in the 101st Airborne, we're scared. Have these guys fly around because we're scared. There's a reason why you're scared, because you don't know how to fight a modern war. And if you go to war against Russia, you'll get slaughtered. So hopefully there's enough smart people to understand that outcome and war is averted. But you're 100% correct to be nervous, afraid, concerned, because it's a dangerous situation.
All right. So we were talking about options, and we actually apply our philosophy to live events also. If you go to scottritterextra.com/uncancelled, you'll have links to Eventbrite pages where you can see that you can make reservations to attend Scott without even paying anything. We are relying on those of our supporters who are able to make a donation. So either way, we make sure everybody gets in.
Now, each one of these is going to be a drink tank event.
Yes, and the first one is going to be at a private home. You can guess whose. And then the other two, the one in Elgin is in a bar, and the one in Dripping Springs is a restaurant with a bar.
Go back to that digital book with a digital signature. I already have a digital book or ebook. Now, if you're serious about this, please email Jeff with what you mean by a digital signature and what that constitutes. Because if I can do that, if you're serious about this, I mean, I have no problem with people telling jokes.
I didn't see this, but I think some people got the wrong impression. This might be another example. But when we were talking about the autographed book not being available in other countries, some people got the impression we were saying the book in general can't be bought in other countries, but it can be. So that might be another.
Right. But what I'm getting at is if I can take the ebook, mm-hmm. and if there's a way that Diana Collier at Clarity Press on the signature page of the ebook, or, you know, the title page, if we can put a little block there where I can electronically autograph it, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a different thing. Okay. But I also want
to have technology. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's look into it.
Okay.
We'll charge you more because, you know, what the hell?
All right, come see us in Texas. All those towns in Texas are in the Austin area, by the way, in case you don't know. And here's how to get Scott's autograph book that we were just talking about. And please watch our other podcast, Scenes from the Evolution, which we'll have Sunday as usual at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We have I forgot his last name, unfortunately, Arcady, the attorney who interviewed you not too long ago from San Francisco. Good guy. We're going to have him on Sunday, and we'll be back Friday night for our usual loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. We're usually on for about 2 hours, and Scott gets into it very extensively. Thanks to Kevin Michelizzi for curating the questions backstage. Great job as usual. Thank you, Scott, and thanks to our beloved audience.
Thanks, guys.